Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 3rd of June, these are our main stories. South Africa's president makes it clear he intends to head a coalition government after the once dominant ANC sees its support slump in elections. After his historic conviction, Donald Trump says he's okay with going to jail, but he doesn't think the American public will stand for it. Mexicans vote in polls expected to produce the country's first female president after the most violent campaign in living history. Also in this podcast,
photos of Mr. Murdoch's latest wedding were published in the Sun newspaper. They show a smiling couple, her in a white dress, him in a blue suit and a pair of trainers.
The media tycoon Rupert Murdoch marries for a fifth time at the age of 93. President Cyril Ramaphosa has described South Africa's election results as a victory for its democracy, despite his party losing its majority for the first time. The final result gave the party he leads, the ANC, 159 seats in the 400-seat parliament. This represents a sharp drop in support, and the ANC has started talks with other parties to form a coalition. The former president, Jacob Zuma, did not attend the announcement of the final results on Sunday and has hinted that he may challenge them. Our Africa correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, reports from Johannesburg.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the ceremony to announce the results of the 2024 national and provincial elections.
The official announcement of results we already knew, the ceremony rubber-stamping the decline of the African National Congress. The President Cyril Ramaphosa said the people had spoken, but he made a broader call for political parties to find common ground in response, apparently preparing the ground for coalition talks.
What this election has made plain is that the people of South Africa expect their leaders to work together to meet their needs. They expect the parties for which they have voted to find common ground, to overcome their differences, to act and work together for the good of everyone. That is what the people of South Africa have said.
Earlier today, the ANC met its disastrous election performance head-on, the outcome of voter anger over economic failures and corruption scandals. The Secretary General, Fikile Mbalula, said the party was not down and out, but there was nothing to celebrate.
The results send a clear message to the ANC. We wish to assure the people of South Africa that we have heard their concerns, their frustrations, and their dissatisfaction. And the election results show that we need to intensify and accelerate the fundamental renewal of our movement.
The clock on coalition talks starts now. Not easy, because the weakened ANC will most likely have to share power with a major political rival. But which one?
Are you able to say how coalition talks are going?
No, I don't just walk up and comment. It doesn't work that way.
This ANC official refused to drop any hints when I doorstepped him in the Election Results Center.
And you're here, BBC sent you here.
Yes.
So you shouldn't just wake up and get into a plane and come here.
No, I jump into every opportunity. That's what I do.
What we know is that the talks will be fraught with consequence because the major parties have different visions for the country. The election is over, but South Africans are still waiting to see how it impacts their nation.
That report by Barbara Plett-Usher. After his criminal conviction, the first for any former or sitting US president, the consensus has been that Donald Trump probably won't go to jail for falsifying business records. But now, in what's being seen as a veiled threat, Mr. Trump has said he would accept a sentence of house arrest or even jail time, but that he didn't think the American public would stand for it. A senior Democrat, Adam Schiff, accused Mr. Trump of making what amounted to a dangerous appeal to violence. From Washington, here's Will Vernon.
Most legal experts say it's unlikely Donald Trump will receive a prison sentence, as he's a first-time offender convicted of a low-level crime. But there is huge speculation here about whether the judge could still decide to confine the former president to a jail cell. In an interview with the conservative network Fox News, Mr. Trump was asked about the possibility of house arrest or prison. "I'm okay with it," he said, before adding,
"I don't know that the public would stand it, you know. I'm not sure the public would stand for it. I think it would be tough for the public to take. You know, at a certain point, there's a breaking point."
President Biden and his supporters have criticized the bellicose language used by Donald Trump, calling it reckless and dangerous.
Will Vernon. It's already the bloodiest election in Mexico's modern history. After a campaign marked by violence and intimidation in which dozens of local candidates have been murdered, Mexicans are choosing members of Congress, state governors and local officials, as well as a new president to replace Andrés Manuel López Obrador. It's widely expected they will elect Mexico's first female president, as both of the leading candidates for that role are women. In a country where around 10 women or girls are murdered each day, many regard this as a historic breakthrough, including this voter, Monica Martinez, queuing outside a polling station in Mexico City.
The fact that people vote for a candidate who's a woman implies a lot of change at all levels. That means it's already beginning to be good. But the fact that it's for a presidential candidate is much more significant.
Thousands of security personnel have been deployed to protect voters. Our correspondent, Will Grant, spoke to us from another polling station in Mexico City as people cast their votes there.
I spent the morning at a polling station in Mexico City, an area which was very quiet, leafy, green, very orderly queues, not that much security, although obviously police on hand, and everything seemed to be going through very calmly and very well. All three candidates, main candidates, particularly the two leading candidates, the women that you spoke of there, Claudia Sheinbaum for the governing party and Xochitl Galvez for an opposition coalition, they've all cast their votes in Mexico City too, as has President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. But that's not to paint the picture as uniformly calm across the country. There are, unfortunately, areas where people simply won't be able to vote. Down in Chiapas, at least two municipalities had to suspend the vote because of cartel-related violence, including masked gunmen going into the electoral offices of one municipality, setting it on fire, and obviously all of the ballot papers were in the building at the time, and they're all lost. So the entire election in that town has had to be suspended.
And can you just explain to us why there has been so much violence in this election?
Why it's particularly bad this time is a hard one to answer. I mean, detractors of the president would say it's because he simply doesn't have a handle on crime and insecurity in Mexico. I think other people, his supporters, would say he's inherited a very, very bad situation, that he's stabilized it somehow, and that it even, you know, little by little is beginning to make inroads on the murder rate. But I think the truth be told, this is a very violent election, the most violent in living memory. And it's just simply the case that the cartels are making their stamp on this vote. They're making their presence known, whether or not that's through the murder of the candidates, which is obviously awful, but also the intimidation, the forcing candidates off the ballot, the placing of gunmen at and near and around polling stations, the instructions, alleged instructions to vote for certain parties, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it has been a terrible vote in those terms, a terrible campaign.
And whoever wins, will it make much difference? Is there much between the two leading contenders?
Well, it'll make a difference in terms of, you know, the political vision of the two sides that are very, very opposed. In terms of tackling security, both women face an extremely difficult and challenging task.
Will Grant to Mexico. 2 days after President Biden unexpectedly unveiled what he said was a new Israeli peace plan for Gaza, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is coming under pressure from all sides, even as he appears to be pouring cold water on the deal. The US criticism of the high death toll in Gaza is intensifying. Relatives of hostages held there are calling on him to accept this latest plan, but two far-right ministers have threatened to bring down his coalition if he does. An aide to Mr. Netanyahu confirmed that Israel had accepted the framework being put forward by Mr. Biden, but described it as flawed. And a senior member of the Knesset for the Prime Minister's Likud party, Hanok Milwitsky, said the current plan did not go far enough.
The coalition is not divided on this at all. The Biden proposal, as was mentioned in his Friday speech, is completely unacceptable on the entire part of the coalition. The Israeli proposal that has been on the table for almost 2 weeks now is talking about not a permanent ceasefire, but a temporary ceasefire in order to release hostages and then start the negotiation to see what would be the outcome of the end result in Gaza. The demands of the Israeli government has not changed. That means Hamas can no longer rule Gaza, can no longer have any capability, not military, and not any civilian capability to be in power. And all the hostages needs to come back. The war will not stop until these demands are met, and we will accept no other terms.
We got more on this confusing situation from our Middle East correspondent Hugo Beshega in Jerusalem.
Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be caught between two options, ceasefire or coalition. Unsurprisingly, two of his far-right ministers have rejected a plan for the war in Gaza, which was laid out by President Biden. Describing the deal as unacceptable, the finance minister Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's national security minister, have threatened to quit if it goes ahead. This could lead to the collapse of the coalition. The head of the opposition has offered to support the government if the ministers do resign, which would make Mr. Netanyahu dependent on people who have been highly critical of him. He hasn't responded yet. Since the proposal was announced on Friday, Mr. Netanyahu's office has only issued two statements, short and vague, without explicitly supporting the deal, which President Biden described as an Israeli proposal. The families of the hostages are holding another protest outside Mr. Netanyahu's office in Jerusalem to urge him to support the plan. Hamas has said it will accept the proposal if Israel does.
Hugo Beshega. And staying with Gaza, as the fighting there continues, the UN Humanitarian News Service, ReliefWeb, has said there's been a sharp rise in the number of people with disabilities in Gaza. And the circumstances of those who are already disabled have worsened further. The BBC's Disability and Mental Health podcast, Access All, recently managed to speak to an 18-year-old woman, Bushra, who has muscular dystrophy. She's been on the move like thousands of other people. And she's been telling her story from Deir al-Balah to Alex Collins.
Before the war, things were different. It wasn't easy. There was no support for people with my condition, especially in school. I could only go to classes on the ground floor as I couldn't use the stairs. But my dad adapted the house to help with my condition. There were handrails near the toilet and more handrails to help move me when I wanted to get around the house.
So life was hard before the war, but things got even harder?
Absolutely. I had to leave my house in the east of Jabalia in the first month of the war after evacuation orders were given to head south. I now live in a tent with 20 people, which is difficult because I can't lean on the plastic edges of it as it won't take my weight. I need a wheelchair to go to the toilet, and I need people to help me. It's been very, very hard to get one. I was borrowing a wheelchair from someone else, but I lost it. And so now I am borrowing another one from some other people when they let me use it. That is, which is not often. I'm telling my story on a crowdfunding page, a GoFundMe website to help myself and my family. The situation is very serious, and I could die at any time. I want to raise enough money to leave Gaza. Once I get the money, I'll get a wheelchair.
It sounds very loud where you are.
It's always noisy. The drones, the bombings, the fighting. It's obviously not great, but what can we do? We've got used to it. We might have to move. We are in Deir el-Balah, but we might have to move to Khan Yunis. It's hard to move from one place to another. I have to have help from my family. I had to go to the hospital last month to get my heart checked, as it's affected by my condition. The war just made everything more stressful. I've had no support the past 7 months. Nothing from any of the aid agencies.
Do you know other people with disabilities? What have they been telling you?
There are lots of people now in Gaza with disabilities. People who've lost limbs, their hands and their legs. They need things like prosthetics and walking sticks. But in Gaza, they're hard to find.
Bushra speaking to Alex Collins. And if you want to hear more on this, just search for Access All on BBC Sounds. China has long insisted it's neutral in the Ukraine war, despite the US alleging that it's helping Moscow by sending it components for weapons. Now, President Zelensky has accused China of attempting to undermine his upcoming global peace summit in Switzerland. Mr. Zelensky said China was not only refusing to take part, but was along with Russia trying to stop other countries from attending. He was speaking at an Asian security forum in Singapore. Our reporter, Suranjana Tiwari, listened to what he had to say.
Vladimir Zelensky stole the show at the summit attended by defense chiefs from around the world, arriving almost unannounced to applause in a packed lobby. As he addressed delegates on the final day, he talked of the need for support for his vision of peace, starting with a summit in Switzerland later this month. Mr. Zelensky said it would focus on achieving nuclear security, food security, and the release of prisoners of war and Ukrainian children held in Russia. He said 106 countries had signed up. But he said Russia was trying to dissuade other states from attending the event and that China was working to do so as well.
We are disappointed that some world leaders have not yet confirmed their participation in the peace summit. Unfortunately, there are also attempts to disrupt the summit. We do not want to believe that this is a desire for monopolistic power in the world to deny the global community the opportunity to decide on war and peace and to leave this power in the hands of one or two.
China says it has not taken sides in the Ukraine war, but the failure to invite Russia to the Swiss meeting undermined its usefulness as a peace forum.
Suranjana Tiwari. Rupert Murdoch has married for a fifth time at a ceremony in California. The 93-year-old media tycoon and his new wife, the retired scientist Yelena Zhukova, celebrated their marriage at his vineyard with family and friends. Joe Inwood reports.
Rupert Murdoch built one of the world's most powerful media empires. News Corp and Fox Corp are worth billions. But his marriages have never been quite as successful as his businesses. His first to the flight attendant and model, Patricia Booker, lasted 11 years. They had one daughter, Prudence, but divorced in 1967. Next was the Scottish journalist Anna Torf, to whom he was married for 32 years. She was working at one of his newspapers and had requested an interview with him. They had three children, Elizabeth, Lachlan and James. That ended when he met Wendy Deng in 1999. She too was an employee of Mr. Murdoch, working for Hong Kong-based Star TV. They got married aboard his yacht, Morning Glory. Wendy Deng famously defended her husband from a pie-throwing protester at a British parliamentary inquiry into phone hacking by his companies.
The sitting is suspended for 10 minutes.
Then came Jerry Hall, the ex-partner of Rolling Stone Mick Jagger. The supermodel reportedly learned of the end of their marriage via email. Last spring, he announced his engagement to Anne Leslie Smith, before calling it off 2 weeks later because she was said to be too religious. Which brings us to the fifth Mrs. Murdoch. Elena Zhukova is a retired Russian molecular biologist. She was also previously married to Russian oil billionaire Alexander Zhukov, while their daughter Dasha, a socialite and businesswoman, was married to the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich. Photos of Mr. Murdoch's latest wedding were published in the Sun newspaper. They show a smiling couple, her in a white dress, him in a blue suit and a pair of trainers. The paper, which of course he owns, said they celebrated their big day with delighted relatives at a ceremony blessed with blue skies and warm sunshine. The ups and downs of Mr. Murdoch's love life have sometimes resembled the tabloid stories that help fuel his empire. He'll be hoping that this time around, it's a happy ending.
Joe Inwood. Still to come.
If you look at the pictures, if you see any footage of the island, it's completely overcrowded. It's very small, maximum half a kilometre.
Why residents of a small island off the coast of Panama are relocating to the mainland.
I'm Suzanne Wilton, and for more than two decades, I've been searching for the truth behind the world's largest gold hoax.
We were sitting on one of the largest gold deposits that the world had ever found.
A motherlode across the world in Indonesia.
A billion-dollar con on a scale never seen before or since.
It looks like they've invented the deposit.
This is a scam.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
People were willing to roll the dice at any cost.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Member states of the World Health Organization have agreed to keep alive negotiations on a pandemic treaty for another year. The talks have been complicated by strong disagreements, especially about how to share vaccines. From Geneva, here's Imogen Folks.
The World Health Organization pushed hard for this treaty, hoping the trauma of COVID-19, 7 million dead, huge economic damage, and the misery of lockdowns would spur countries to act. But deep divisions remain, especially over vaccine sharing. Finally, countries agreed to extend the negotiations by 1 year, and they agreed to update existing international health regulations with a new category of pandemic emergency aimed at strengthening the global response to new health risks.
Imogen, folks. It's a striking aerial image, a tiny island crammed with hundreds of homes with only the odd tree poking up here and there and a couple of narrow roads. Now hundreds of residents of Guardisudup off Panama's Caribbean coast are packing up their belongings because of climate change. With many of their houses only half a metre above sea level, residents have been offered the chance to relocate to the mainland where new homes have been built for them. And it's thought that other communities could soon follow. Our Americas editor, Leonardo Rocha, told us more.
If you look at the pictures, if you see any footage of the island, it's completely overcrowded. It's very small, maximum half a kilometre one direction and 150 metres on the other direction. And they have two problems there, the problem of overcrowding and finding space, and they have the problem of rising seas because it's just off the coast of Panama. Most houses are about half a meter to 1 meter above sea level. And what they've noticed is that for a long time now, in the rainy season, the houses have been flooded more and more often. So they've been asking the government to replace them. They say, we can't stay here. Residents have also mentioned the problem with this waste disposal and the lack of water. So life hasn't become practical for them, basically unsustainable. And the Guna people, they came from what is now northern Colombia. And when Panama became independent from Colombia, they moved to that region about 200 years ago to the islands. And now they're moving to the mainland.
Where exactly are they going to go? And how do they feel about being uprooted in this way?
It's interesting because when I read about it, I thought they would be very angry. But no, they're very excited. Most of the people heard are excited about it. They say they couldn't stay there. They say it's practical problems. They say the houses are too small, it's overcrowded, the children have no space to play. And they helped the government develop this new area, which is just inland. When you go inland, it's a jungle area, and they help design the houses in sort of, you know, the traditional ways that they like, you know, in all close by where the communities can be together. And it's very interesting because it's a story of climate change where you imagine that people will be very angry about it and the way of life. They earn a lot, their living through agriculture that they will continue to do, fishing, which they probably will if they're not far from the coast, and tourism, which might continue. But what is interesting is that these families are very excited with the new changes, the new life that they will have there.
And campaign groups are calling these people some of the first climate change refugees of the Americas, but there are expected to be many more communities who will be relocated this way at great cost to governments.
Yes, of course, these Guna indigenous people, they inhabited another 50 islands, more or less, in the same region. I mean, they probably are not as overcrowded as the one that they're being abandoned now. But this is a problem coming to the whole of the Caribbean, where most islands are very low, close to the sea. What the scientists are saying is this is a good example, but it's in a very small scale. How are you going to move inland whole populations? And not only that, you have to also take into account landslides, rivers that might also flood. It's a huge effort, and this is only a good example, but it doesn't reflect the scale of the problem coming in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Leonardo Rocha. China says it successfully landed an uncrewed craft on the far side of the moon. The mission aims to collect precious rock and soil from the region for the first time in history. The craft touched down in a huge crater known as the South Pole Aitken Basin. The European Space Agency has a role in the operation. Paul Henley spoke to Neil Melville, a technical officer with ESA and Mission Control in Beijing, and began by asking him about the moment of touchdown on the moon.
Of course, everyone around us was very excited at the moment of the landing. It's not their first time. It's, in fact, their fourth time landing on the moon. So they've clearly got quite good at it now. But immediately back to work, because there's an awful lot to do.
And what is the significance of this particular landing?
Well, this mission is attempting to retrieve some samples from the far side of the moon, which would be a first. No one's ever done this before. The far side of the moon is actually made of quite different rock than the near side that we can see. And it's quite a lot older, and it should tell us a lot more about the formation of the moon and of the solar system in general. So it's really a kind of scientific treasure trove.
And a definite advance on the samples that they could get from the near side.
Yes, just because the nature of them is different, but also it's a technological advance. It's quite a lot harder to operate a mission on the far side of the moon for the simple fact that the moon is in the way. So you can't have direct line of communication. You need to use relay satellites, which adds a whole level of technological complexity.
Tell us about your role in this project. It's significant, isn't it, what you're working on?
CNSA, the Chinese National Space Agency, they invited international partners to propose payloads to join them on the Chang'e 6 mission. And I work for the European Space Agency, and we have joined them with a payload called Negative Ions on the Lunar Surface, NILS, which, just as the name suggests, is looking to detect negative ions on the lunar surface. These are the things that should be kicked up by the solar wind impacting on the moon, because the moon doesn't have a magnetic field to shield it the way the Earth does, which is why we don't see auroras on the moon, but we do see them here. Our science has very good models, we think, we hope, of what should be happening on the lunar surface when this occurs. But no one's ever measured it directly. We need to measure it on the surface in situ to find out if our scientific understanding is correct of the solar wind, of how that interacts with planetary bodies that don't have any magnetic shield. But also because that will inform us about the environment on the surface for future missions, for robotic missions, for crewed missions. We need to know what the population of ions is there, the charges, the type of plasma, etc., because we're going to design equipment and take people to live and work there.
You're working hand in hand with the Chinese, and being in mission control seems to negate some of the talk of the space race and the jealously guarded secrets of the Chinese mission.
As I say, CNSA invited international cooperation. There is indeed an acceleration lately in missions to the moon, and the Chinese themselves are going very fast. we can only congratulate them for their astonishing achievements. Of course, ESA was founded on the principle of international cooperation. We have 27 member states and associate member states. We've known for a very long time that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And that's not just true at a European level. Of course, that's true at a global level. So we're very happy to be invited to be involved. It's great to collaborate and we can achieve more together like that.
So you don't think the world, and particularly the West, has anything to fear from China's resurgent space program? There's been speculation about China exploring, well, actually about everybody exploring military opportunity in space.
This mission is purely scientific. I see no other component to it. Science inherently should be for the good of everyone and a peaceful endeavor, of course. I wouldn't like to think of it as a race where we're competing with each other, but it should be a journey that we're trying to go on together. And if the achievements of one agency or one nation inspire the greater efforts of another, then that's all to the good as far as I'm concerned.
Neil Melville, technical officer with the European Space Agency. One of the most successful rugby league players in history, Rob Burrow, has died at the age of 41. The Leeds Rhinos player was diagnosed with motor neurone disease in 2019, just 2 years after his retirement. He raised millions to help others with the same condition. Our rugby league correspondent, Matt Newsome, looks back at his life.
Brave, dazzling, defiant and humble. Four words that encapsulate perfectly the remarkable Rob Burrow. The tiny boy in ill-fitting padding, playing rugby league in his hometown of Castleford, became a giant of his sport despite his diminutive figure. 8 grand final rings, 2 Challenge Cups and 3 World Club Challenge honours came with the Leeds Rhinos, whom he supported avidly like his father Jeff. He realised those dreams and represented his country too. Rob Burrow was diagnosed with motor neurone disease in 2019. He opened up his story to the public and with it captured hearts and minds. He was a terrific player and a man who inspired millions.
Matt Newsome with that look back on the life of Rob Burrow, who has died at the age of 41. And now to the story of another inspiring figure, a British woman who was told she would not live past the age of 16. Sophie Holmes has cystic fibrosis, a condition which causes the lungs to produce excessive amounts of mucus. Well, she's defied the medical establishment in style. She's just set a world record for running 36 marathons in 36 days. Think about that for a moment. Cystic fibrosis often causes severe respiratory problems, and yet Sophie is a long-distance runner. She told us how she started.
To give some context, when I was 19, obviously surpassing the original prediction of my health, I did actually become really unwell. And they did say then, well, you might only have a couple of years left. And I sat there as a 19-year-old with the power of naivety going, no, I don't believe you. We can do something about this. And so I started running a lot more, training. And I promised myself that if I made 30, I wanted to celebrate. But when I made 30, it was lockdown and the goal of running 30 marathons in 30 days wasn't possible. And so I thought, OK, well, we'll bench the idea and see what happens. Last year, I entered the Edinburgh Marathon. I got into the London Marathon. I thought, hang on a minute, how many days are between these two races? And that's where the 36 was born. It was kind of a random number due to the circumstance. But I was like, what's a few more, you know? My dad was the crew for 33 of them and he was fantastic. And I was fortunate enough that come rain or shine, he was standing there somewhere en route in his high vis ready to give me some water and things. And so that was a really special moment, finishing them with him. And I guess if I was going to put anything out there to anyone, it would just be, just don't give up. Like, don't stop going after your goals, even if things are hard, because I'm a firm believer of, you know, things are possible if you just keep going 1% a day, keep pushing. Because when obviously I was younger, I got told I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't achieve anything, so what's the point? And I fought back against that. And so by me doing this, I'm hoping that I would provide hope to families with CF, people with CF, or people facing hard times or adversity, but also inspire people just to go after those goals, because sure, we really only have one shot at this life, and so why not?
The marathon runner and cystic fibrosis sufferer, Sophie Holmes. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jancis Haycox. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Suzanne Wilton, and for more than two decades, I've been searching for the truth behind the world's largest gold hoax.
We were sitting on one of the largest gold deposits that the world had ever found.
A mother lode across the world in Indonesia.
A billion-dollar con on a scale never seen before or since.
It looks like they've invented the deposit.
This is a scam.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
People were willing to roll the dice at any cost.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.